Hello, my name's Neil Ferguson. I try to run the Hoover History Working Group here at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And we've just had the privilege of hearing a terrific presentation from Kelly Hammond, who's an assistant professor of East Asian history in the Department of History at the University of Arkansas. The first book project that Kelly talked about is China's Muslims and Japan's Empire, Centering Islam in World War II, which was just published by the University of North Carolina Press. But she also talks about her next book project and gave us, I think, an exciting foretaste of what's coming next in her research. Kelly, thanks so much for coming to the History Working Group. Let me ask you first to talk a bit about how Muslims fit into the complex pattern of conflict that we call World War II, and in particular, what their role was in the war in East Asia.
Great. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me, Neil, and it's great to be here with the Hoover Working Group. And from the perspective of the work that I've just finished, the Muslims that I'm specifically dealing with in my book weren't really involved so much in fighting against the Japanese. They were definitely more involved in the sort of intellectual and ideological pursuits of what the Japanese Empire was trying to achieve in East Asia. And so through collaboration with the Japanese Empire, the majority of the Muslim actors who are in my book sort of envisioned a way for themselves to implement reform agendas through education and through, you know, the building of new schools or through, you know, sponsorship to go on the Hajj. And they really sort of saw the Japanese Empire as presenting them with an opportunity that they might not otherwise get from the Chinese nationalists or the Chinese communists or even from the Soviets at that time.
How far was this just a case of my enemy's enemy is my friend? Or was there really something positive that the Japanese Empire had to offer?
Yeah, in some cases, I do think, in some ways, I do think it was sort of the lesser of all evils, you know, working, maybe perhaps working with the Japanese. They were able to implement things that the Chinese nationalists and the Chinese communists just couldn't get done at the time. But I think the way that we can sort of gauge that is by looking at the ways that the Chinese nationalists and the Chinese communists both reacted to the Japanese efforts to sort of curry favors to Muslims. And from the research that I've done, it seems quite clear that the Chinese nationalists in particular were quite concerned with the success, the quote unquote successes that the Japanese were having on the ground with Muslims in China and with recruiting Muslims in China. And I think part of that, Neil, had to do with the own sort of hollowness of their own ethnic policies at the time. They had this sort of grand rhetoric and grand strategy, but on the ground, they really weren't doing much to support ethnic or religious minorities who found themselves living in China during this time.
As a historian of Europe, I have vivid recollections of studying Waffen-SS Muslim units recruited in Eastern Europe and in World War II. It strikes me that you're telling us a different story, and your presentation had images of kids from Muslim communities studying Japanese. It seemed an altogether more civilian enterprise than what happened in the European theater. Talk a little bit about how the Japanese nationalists and imperialists thought about Islam, because I remember looking at the ways the Nazis rationalized Islam and Muslim collaborators as part of the Third Reich. Was there a similar kind of rationalization of the way Islam could fit into a Japanese empire?
I think in some ways it was similar, but like I think you mentioned, it is quite different, and there are no sort of SS units in, you know, that are equivalents to that in the Japanese theater or in the Pacific theater. I think a lot of that actually has to do with the sort of longer relationship of these areas with Islam, and the fact that in the majority of these places, Muslims are a vast minority. Also, it has to do with the fact that until really the 1920s and 1930s, there were almost no Muslims in Japan, only a very few, a handful of converts. And then the first Muslim community is actually a group of people who come fleeing Russian persecution or fleeing Bolshevik persecution and make their way to Tokyo. So the fact that there were really no Muslims in Japan, number one, they kind of had to make Muslims understandable to people living on the home islands. They had to teach Japanese people about who Muslims were. And I think the utility that they saw wasn't sort of a let's send them out and fight. It was more of a geopolitical or geostrategical, like let's make alliances with places beyond Asia, using these people to help us create networks in, you know, North Africa, in the Middle East, in South Asia, by showing our, you know, quote unquote, benevolence and our support for this group of people.
I was really fascinated by the Saudi connection, which I hadn't known about. Yeah. Japan, of course, had a chronic problem where the minute American sanctions were imposed with oil shortages. Oil. So talk a little bit about how oil plays into this story in the 1940s.
Right. So late 1930s, late 1938, the Japanese government decides that they are going to send, they're going to sponsor a Hajj delegation of Chinese Muslims who, on the process of going on the Hajj, meet with a number of members of the royal Saudi family, which obviously is something that's prearranged. And they also create the sort of grease the diplomatic wheels to sort of get Japanese diplomats to be able to go to negotiate for an oil concession. So April 1939, right before, you know, the war starts in Europe, this negotiation had to happen when it did. It wouldn't have happened after September 1939. The Japanese send some very high-ranking diplomats to Saudi Arabia to try to negotiate for an oil concession, which gets rebuffed. And I've seen in the British archives that the British were aghast and the Americans were not impressed that this was happening either. So there was definitely pressure from the British and the Americans to sort of get the Saudis to say no. There was definitely, you know, it's like it's one of those what would have beens had the Japanese secured an oil concession in Saudi Arabia in 1939, things might have turned out very differently.
Well, I'm always a sucker for counterfactual questions.
Yeah, me too.
Let's talk a little bit about the Nix project, which takes the story forward into the Cold War. Mm-hmm. What are going to be the themes of this new project, and how? Let me put it broadly, how different is this geopolitical setting for the people you're interested in?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the things that I've sort of noticed in the writing and the readings that I've done in the early 50s and early 60s is, number one, just how anti-communist and how Western the propaganda is, especially coming out of nationalist Taiwan and, mostly coming out of nationalist Taiwan. And I saw some of that sort of resonating with what the Japanese propaganda from the 1930s and 1940s, this very staunch anti-Soviet, anti-Western angle. And so I started getting curious about how, number one, the post-occupation government in Japan, so after 1952, after the San Francisco Treaty, as well as the government in exile, the nationalist government in exile in Taiwan, and the People's Republic of China government, the communist government in China, how they were handling their outreach and their relationships, especially with new post-colonial Muslim states, like, you know, Indonesia, which has a massive Muslim population and early on started out being, you know, under Sukarno started out being sort of socialist leaning and then flipped over to being staunchly anti-communist under Suharto. So we see sort of some backdoor negotiations taking place. And my first work is really a social and cultural history, but my second work is really more, I think, going to be a diplomatic and institutional history, looking at events like the Bandung Conference and looking at the backdoor negotiations that are taking place between Chinese Muslims, Japanese diplomats, and Chinese, communist-supported Chinese Muslims, and how they're trying to sort of get present themselves to these new post-colonial Muslim states in the early years of the Cold War. And looking for allies.
And I, as I work on the Cold War, writing the biography of Henry Kissinger, I'm constantly right. struck by how unbipolar it was and how much more right. complex and how much more of a multiplayer game the Cold War was. Well, a lot of the places you're talking about, from Xinjiang to Taiwan, are in the news today. And part of mm-hmm. what we try and do at the Hoover History Working Group is to apply history. So let me conclude by asking you, how do you see our contemporary situation, given that the situation of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang mm-hmm. is now a hugely important issue in not only US relations with China, but the relations of the rest of the world with China, and given that Taiwan looks more and more like the focal point of, well, maybe Cold War II, right. give us some historical perspective on the new significance of these places that you know so well.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people want us to sort of draw analogies to the past, but I see what's happening in Xinjiang now as being completely different from what has happened before. And the policies that are being implemented by the Xi administration and the party state are really assimilative in ways that were not really possible before because of the types of technologies and the ways that the Chinese party state has been able to sort of vilify this population in the post 9/11 world. But if I was going to offer a sort of lesson from history, I think it would be the ways that, you know, most of the time these authoritative states do need to make some sort of compromises. And the difference that I see right now is that the Xi regime doesn't have to make those. They are able to sort of implement, you know, we're seeing it happening in Hong Kong with the new security law. And I see constant parallels between what's happening in Xinjiang and what's happening in Hong Kong. And sadly, what seems to be further more and more the case in Taiwan. So, you know, I really hate to end these things on a depressing and sad note, but as much as we can learn from history, I do think that this is a very distinct and different period, owing to the sort of technology that the Xi regime has at its disposal. And I don't think things are going to get better before they get much worse.
Well, thanks for that sobering reflection, but one can always take it, I think, as being meaningful when historians say that things are new or unprecedented. I think you're probably right. There's never really been quite such an aggressive and homogenizing Chinese state and power in Beijing. Kelly, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. at the Hoover History Working Group. We all wish you huge success with the published book and, of course, with the book that has yet to come, which I shall look forward very much to reading. Thanks a lot.